Hey friends, this episode of The Fellow on Call is not meant to be used for medical advice and is intended for educational purposes only. Patient information has been modified to ensure privacy. The views expressed in this episode do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers. Enjoy!
Welcome to another episode of The Fellow on Call, the HemOnc podcast. We're coming at you from Rollo University Medical Center. I'm Ronak.
I'm Vivek.
And I'm Dan.
And in today's episode, we continue on our CLL-SLL discussion. Last time we talked all about how we work up these patients, the natural progression of the disease, and some of the information we're going to use to counsel our patients. And today we move on to our episode talking all about treatment.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into this one. We'll recap a little bit about last week, but really get into how we treat these patients and how we counsel them on it.
Yeah, treatments have evolved with many disease states, with CLL a lot in the past 5-10 years. So we got a lot of good stuff to talk about.
Sounds good, guys. Well, let's go ahead and roll that show. So before we start today's episode, last time we talked about what is in Dan's current wine cellar. I think today I'd like to follow up on that conversation with what's everybody cooking? I mean, what's going with the wines that we're all talking about? Vivek's Costco and Trader Joe's wine, the fancy wine that I can't pronounce that Dan mentioned. What has been a great recipe that you've tried recently that you want to share with our listeners?
Well, one of my standbys has been this, I think it's a Epicurious developed recipe for turmeric stained salmon with Swiss chard and a little coconut chili crisp on top. It is just superb. Nice, feels healthy. I don't know if it is that healthy. It's probably a lot of calories with the salmon on there. But yeah, Logan and I love that for the wintertime.
Yeah, that's a fancy course. I'll have to say for my fanciness, I made a beef burgundy the other day. It was very good. Dan's face was shocked that I made a beef burgundy. You know, I used some wine. I did some braising in the wine. I did a good job, Dan. I did a good job. Made a little roux with the flour and the butter, you know? Hey, I did it. We had a beef burgundy recently and it was very delicious. It's also, you know, it's a lot of steps, but it's so delicious. Totally worth it. 100% recommend. I made some mashed potatoes using the potato ricer. I have to admit it was one of the best recipes I've ever made, but just Google beef burgundy and just do it. It tastes so good. It's totally worth it.
Before I say what I've been trying, I want to, Vivek, you have so many kitchen appliances. Like I feel like you have an appliance for literally everything. What did you just say? A rice masher, potato ricer? What do you say?
Potato ricer. You got to have the potato ricer, man. That's the only way to make good mashed potatoes. It's that good creamy mashed potato, you know? You know, take your little pot, have some butter and heavy cream in it, pour that stuff in. It just makes the perfect. You don't need potato masher, potato ricer.
I've literally never heard of that in my entire life, but what I've been working on. So listeners, a few weeks back, Dan had us over to his place and he made these incredible chicken shawarmas, which in itself was phenomenal. But in classic Dan Hausrath fashion, he made his own pitas in his pizza oven, which let me tell you, nothing that you can buy at the grocery store tastes good even remotely anymore after having those pitas. I tried to recreate this last week. I actually made like a similar Moroccan style blend of spices and tried to replicate the chicken. The chicken came out great, but I don't know how to make pitas and I don't have access to a pizza oven. So Dan Hausrath, once again, you take home that top seed.
Thanks. Yeah, it was the Anna Olson's recipe on YouTube for whole wheat pita. It's a winner. I'm glad you guys enjoyed it.
I wanted to continue our discussion that we were having last week with a conversation today talking about treatment for CLL. So Vivek, I think you have a really interesting case to set up our discussion today. Do you want to tell us about this patient?
Yeah, so this is a real patient case, you know, obviously taking out the identifying information. So we have a 65-year-old male with history of hypertension and hyperlipidemia who presented to the ED with intractable angina. Labs were notable for a white count of 40,000, hemoglobin of 5.2, and a platelet of 275. Differential showed predominant lymphocytosis at 32,000. Smudge cells were also reported on the peripheral smear. His most recent CBC with his primary care doctor showed a white count of 35, hemoglobin of 14, and platelet of 265 obtained 3 months ago, and the patient was awaiting to be seen by a hematologist. A troponin was elevated, and there was concern for an end-STEMI. He notably had scleral icterus on exam. Type and screen showed a pan-agglutin, is what the blood bank was telling us. CMP was notable for hyperbilirubinemia, and haptoglobin was undetectable. His reticulocyte count was elevated at 20%, and LDH was up at 550. To complicate his clinical picture even more, he developed hematochezia, and CT imaging showed concerns for ischemic colitis. All right, this is a true case. So you get consulted from the ER, you're the hematologist, and they ask, hey, can we transfuse this guy? The blood bank tells me it's incompatible or something. What do you do next? Can you tell us about what incompatible blood is? Let's start with that, the pantagluten and this whole idea of incompatible blood.
Yeah, so that is a super scary question to get from the ED. You hear about it in med school, you hear about it from transfusion medicine lecturers, like, you know, an ABO mismatch is the scariest thing to think about. It just massive hemolysis, intravascular hemolysis, catastrophic event. Like, if you suspect it, you don't wait, you pinch the line, stop anything more from going into that patient, and then, you know, start your workup. But in this case, that's not really what we're talking about. What it means is that because there is this pantagluten in the bloodstream, which is an autoantibody that's directed against some very common red cell antigen, such that it agglutinates all of the red cells that the blood bank used in their testing panel to try and identify the antibody. That also means that we can't cross-match the patient's blood because they have this antibody that's agglutinating all red cells, including their own. But it is still safe to provide transfused blood to this patient. And in fact, it is necessary in many of the cases because hemolytic anemias tend to be pretty severe anemias. And this patient was, again, having consequences of that anemia. They were having tissue ischemia. So we do want to transfuse, even though we cannot cross-match that blood, because we'll still be able to identify the patient's blood type and provide ABO-compatible units. Backing up, of course, we know that pantagglutinin typically is going to be an IgG or a warm autoimmune antibody, warm autoantibody, pointing us towards a diagnosis of warm autoimmune hemolytic anemia. And we discussed that pretty extensively in our hemolytic anemia series. For managing that, in addition to transfusing to provide oxygenation support to the patient's blood, we want to give high-dose steroids and follow that with a slow taper. And you can review our hemolytic anemia episodes if you want a little bit more detail on that. It's also a good idea generally whenever you're faced with a very severe anemia that you expect a patient to be able to recover from on their own to provide them some folic acid, just making sure that their body has the tools they need to recover. One key thing on this patient's case, in addition to a warm autoimmune hemolytic anemia, we also have a pretty substantial lymphocytosis. And that should get your mind thinking about an underlying cause for this warm hemolytic anemia. In this case, our suspicion is pretty high for CLL. So I definitely want to send off that flow cytometry as well.
That was a great recap. So our patient had flow cytometry, which showed increased B-cell population with the following abnormal immunophenotype: monotypic for kappa, positive for CD5 and CD200. This was consistent with CLL, SLL. We talked about this extensively in our last episode. So our patient was started on high-dose steroids with rituximab and was given blood products over the next several days. The hemoglobin remained stable above 9, didn't require transfusions. Actually, his angina resolved once he got more blood. The hematochezia resolved, and he ended up undergoing a left heart cath, which showed multi-vessel disease, and he had a recommendation for a CABG. So we're going to use this patient to frame our discussion moving forward. But let's back up a second before we get to this patient, whether he should get a CABG or not. Let's say, what if this guy had angina with the same incidentally found high white count, but otherwise normal hemoglobin and platelets? And the surgeon's asking us, hey, can we give this guy a CABG with a white count of 40,000? So, Rona, when do we need to treat CLL patients in general? And can you just do a brief recap on sort of the risk stratification and diagnostic testing for these patients?
Yeah, definitely. Well, this is certainly a challenging case, Vivek, because of how complicated the situation is with the patient's underlying cardiac issues, this underlying hemolytic anemia process, and now these new concerns for CLL. So, listeners, remember last time we talked about the indications for treatment. The first thing to remember is that patients who are largely asymptomatic, it's okay to observe these people. And this can make us and many other clinicians feel very uneasy, especially in the beginning when we haven't seen a lot of CLL, because patients will be walking around with white blood cell counts of 100,000, but they're feeling well. And I want you to remember it's okay to observe these patients safely. On the flip side, the indications for treatment are as follows. So that would be anemia and or thrombocytopenia that is related to the CLL, and this is because of infiltration of the bone marrow. Recurrent autoimmune cytopenias that are related to CLL after initial treatment with steroids and rituximab. If patients are having B symptoms, so that remember that means fevers, night sweats, adenopathy, weight loss, things of that sort. The fourth criteria to consider treating is a lymphocyte doubling time of less than 6 months. And this is, again, why we check that absolute lymphocyte count. If that's doubling super fast, some people use it as an indication to consider treatment. I will say in my experience, that is not a universal sort of guideline that a lot of people follow, especially when patients are still feeling well, but it is something to consider and maybe an indication that more symptoms are going to start happening in the near future. With regards to diagnosis, remember that in most cases, you can spare these patients a bone marrow biopsy because the cells that are causing the problem are circulating around. You can use flow cytometry to identify those CD5 and CD200 positive cells. And also from those cells in the periphery, you can also check FISH and IgHV status, both of which have prognostic implications. Remember that an indication for a bone marrow biopsy, though, are patients that have progressive anemia or thrombocytopenia in the setting of CLL, and you can't quite explain why that's happening. That would be a good reason to go ahead and check a marrow. With regards to imaging, remember that the most important thing is a really good physical exam to appreciate the extent of adenopathy that your patient has. If something doesn't seem quite right or you're worried that, you know, this patient does appear a lot sicker and you want to assess the degree of adenopathy with imaging, you could consider getting a PET CT scan. And one of the reasons to do this is especially if you're worried about what is called a Richter's transformation. And that is the transformation of CLL to a higher grade lymphoma. And we'll talk more about this in a future episode, but remember that you could appreciate these bulky lymph nodes that may be very FDG avid using a PET scan in the situation of Richter's, which if you see this would prompt you to consider getting a lymph node biopsy to be able to make that diagnosis. With all of this in mind, the presence of a newly diagnosed CLL is not a contraindication to undergoing CABG, or the existing CLL that's untreated is not an indication to, or rather a contraindication to undergoing a CABG or any other procedure, and will not impair wound healing. Also, since it's the first time that the patient is having a hemolytic crisis, and presumably from this underlying warm autoimmune hemolytic anemia, after treating the warm autoimmune hemolysis, we can continue to observe this patient. But remember, if there is recurrence, then this is going to be an indication to treat the underlying CLL.
The key points that you were saying here is that at the end of the day, that we have these patients who can be asymptomatic with very high white blood cell counts. There's a patient I'm following with a white blood cell count of 200,000 that's just been stable for years. If they're not having symptoms, you don't necessarily have to treat it. And it's the recurrent autoimmune cytopenias that you really think about, maybe I need to treat the underlying clone. Otherwise, you can just do your regular steroid rituximab treatment kind of thing for a warm autoimmune hemolytic anemia process, knowing that probably about coin flip chance, 50% of patients will have a relapse of their autoimmune condition within about 2 years. So we have this patient here. We ended up treating him with steroids and rituximab. His white count actually normalized. His hemoglobin was stable at 13. He ended up going to surgery, did really well. At the time of surgery, had some mediastinal adenopathy, which was biopsied at the time because I said, why not? We're already in here. Let's take it out. And it showed SLL. So it kind of all fit with his clinical picture. He now recovered very well postoperatively, and he's seeing you in clinic for routine monitoring. Now, 6 months after his CABG, his white count is 35,000. Otherwise, his counts are unremarkable. You then send your risk stratification studies that Ronak had mentioned, the FISH, which was notable for deletion 11Q, and he was found to have an unmutated IgHV. So how often should we think about monitoring his counts? And Dan, can you tell us a little bit about lymphocyte doubling time and you know, our thoughts here at Rouleau University about that?
To your first question, in terms of monitoring, we definitely want to be looking into this patient's count situation every 3 to 4 months for at least a few years. You want to basically get an idea of what their initial trajectory is. And having that nice set of data points up front can really help you do that. If people tend to be a little bit more stable, or it looks like their counts really aren't rising all that quickly, you can consider spreading out to maybe twice a year or every 6 months if they're really stable. In terms of lymphocyte doubling time, that's something you can calculate looking at that set of data that you get on your patients from monitoring them frequently. Lymphocyte doubling time in and of itself is not an absolute indication to treat these patients. There are some folks who will have a more rapid rise at first from sort of the 20s, 30s up to 80s or 100, and then kind of plateau after that, especially in these lower count ranges. Even if somebody seems to have a pretty brisk doubling time, in the absence of other indications for treatment or cytopenias, things like that, you want to kind of see where they're going to go. You want to give them a chance to declare whether or not they're going to even out. That said, if they continue to rise or the counts are getting up into that higher 250, 300,000 range, I tend to pull the trigger on treatment with those patients. We generally aren't worried about leukostasis with these patients. Remember, these are mature cells, relatively speaking, compared to your acute leukemias, where you have these very immature blasts circulating around that are large and kind of sticky. These CLL cells are small and smooth and move through the vessels quite well. So I don't necessarily worry about that so much. And hyperviscosity, those type of issues generally aren't seen until that 250,000, 300,000 range and above. Oftentimes the counts need to really be even higher than that for you to have a problem. Vivek, is there any data to assess whether or not there's an advantage to early treatment? Like those are the thresholds that I'm using when I'm looking at absolute counts. But do we know if treating folks earlier on in the course of their disease changes that disease trajectory at all?
Yeah, it's a great question. We actually didn't have the true answer to this until very recently. There was a study called the CLL-12 trial. So in CLL, they actually just numbered them. It's a lot easier, honestly. But there was a study called CLL-12. And what they did is they compared ibrutinib versus placebo. So ibrutinib is that BTK inhibitor, that pill therapy. So ibrutinib versus placebo. And they included asymptomatic patients with Binet stage A who had an additional risk factor based on the German CLL study group criteria. We had referenced that in our earlier episode, and we'll list some of those criteria in the show notes. But bottom line is this, they not only had asymptomatic, I just have maybe a couple of lymph nodes and a high Y count, but I also had an additional risk factor, whether that was deletion 17P, deletion 11Q, an unmutated IGHV, something like that to say, are we fundamentally changing the course of their disease? Are we making people live longer by treating them earlier? What we found was there was a 3-year EF event-free survival benefit, but no difference in overall survival. So at 3 years, the event-free survival was 85%, and those got ibrutinib for obvious reasons. They got therapy. Of course, they're going to have a better event-free survival versus 60% in the observation group. But this means that 40% of patients never needed treatment. So obviously, you will overtreat patients by doing it earlier, and you're not changing their overall survival. So this trial really solidified the watch and wait approach, regardless of underlying risk factors, even things like a deletion 17P, the highest risk patients.
That's so interesting, and that's such an important thing for us to remember with this disease. Again, I keep saying this, but the numbers scare people, and so it's good to know that we have data to back up while we're doing what we're doing. So let's say in our situation, for instance, like we do have to treat our patient. What kind of data are you sharing with patients? How are you rationalizing what you're going to do in terms of treatment options in the first line for a gentleman like ours?
For our patient, you know, obviously he had this one episode of autoimmune hemolytic anemia, you can just watch him. Let's assume he develops B symptoms. Now his Y count's 100,000 and he's developing B symptoms. We have to treat him. How do we think about this? There was a couple of earlier historical studies that set the backdrop for what we do today. And I'm going to briefly run through those because I still think they're important. The first one's called the CLL-10 trial. And what we used to do is give patients cytotoxic chemotherapy in addition to rituximab. And what did that look like? There was bendamustine rituximab, BR. There was fludarabine, cyclophosphamide, rituximab, SFCR, and there was also chlorambucil. We used the drug chlorambucil. You might not have heard that in a really long time, but that was another treatment option. So what the CLL-10 trial did is they said, well, FCR is kind of toxic. What about bendamustine rituximab? Is that non-inferior? And they found it wasn't. Bendamustine rituximab wasn't non-inferior, so FCR wins. And FCR was a standard of care for quite some time, chemotherapy. But we know patients with deletion 17P, they ain't doing that well. Older patients, they can't tolerate FCR. That's not going well either. And so why did we keep on using it? Well, one thing that came out of the MD Anderson group before was that patients with mutated IGHV, remember that's the better risk patients, they had a more mature B cell that went through the germinal center and had that somatic hypermutation. The mutated group, you got FCR, there was a curative tail at the end of the curve. So we thought that, okay, maybe those patients are doing well. Maybe FCR is all right. But then we developed BTK inhibitors and venetoclax, and the whole script changed at that point. So early on, we had chemotherapy. knowing that FCR was kind of the standard of care. But right now we have things like BTK inhibitors, venetoclax. So I'm going to ask you guys, before we get into that data, what exactly, when you think about a BTK inhibitor, this pill, what are you thinking about side effect profile wise?
Yeah, I mean, a big one you want to counsel patients on is not necessarily something that's super obvious or well-publicized, but it's the first one that comes to mind for me because of my benign hematology inclination. It does have an antiplatelet effect, so these patients are at higher risk for bleeding beyond it. But probably the most famous, if you're not a benign hematologist, is their propensity to cause arrhythmia, and specifically atrial fibrillation, supraventricular tachycardias, that sort of thing. The newer generation ones, I think, have slightly better safety profile in terms of cardiac side effects. But that's probably the one that I think of outside of its antiplatelet effects. That's the one that comes to mind as well.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important to think about. These BTK inhibitors, hypertension, bleeding risk, AFib. Those are the really important things. But these drugs are also incredibly targeted, right? These were designed to target a pathway in these CLL cells. So we had chemotherapy before, but let's move on to the modern era. There's one other trial that sets the stage for what we do today, and that's called the CLL11 trial. Again, all this is in our show notes. We're just giving you the information just so you know. What they did there is they said, well, remember chlorambucil was used back in the day? So you'll see in all these trials, kind of like prostate cancer, they're using the wrong control arm, but that's a discussion for another day. We already hit that home in prostate cancer. This CLL11 trial, though, was obinutuzumab chlorambucil versus rituximab chlorambucil. So the question really was, is obinutuzumab better than rituximab? Both of these medicines are CD20 antibodies, right? So they're anti-CD20. Rituximab is a type 1 antibody. Obinutuzumab is a type 2 antibody. And what does that mean? Well, there's a little bit more antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, more direct cellular cytotoxicity with the type 2 antibody of obinutuzumab. In other words, maybe it has more kung fu and is stronger, was the thought. And what they found was, well, the median PFS actually doubled with obinutuzumab compared to using rituximab. So that really says, well, hey, maybe obinutuzumab in CLL worked. The same thing wasn't true for other diseases like follicular lymphoma and large cell lymphoma, but for CLL, obinutuzumab was better. And that sets the stage. This will make sense when we talk about the modern set of therapies. So I'm going to pause right there. Ronak or Dan, can you tell us a little bit about venetoclax before I get into the pivotal trials that led us to our current treatment options today?
So venetoclax, we hear a lot about it in the literature now. It's a very effective small molecule, targets BCL2. And the way that this works is it essentially induces apoptosis in the cells. It's super effective in a lot of these highly replicating cells, which is, if you remember back to biochemistry, BCL2 plays a critical role in cell survival. So that's the underlying mechanism there. Like I said, we see it used a lot. Eventually, we'll talk about things like AML and things of that sort. We're starting to see this drug being used even in a group of patients with multiple myeloma. So definitely a lot of indications, certainly changing the landscape, but plays a really big role in the way that we manage our CLL patients.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. So these CLL cells survived because they upregulated BCL2. So they're like, I'm not going to die. And this exploits that and is more, it puts them in a more pro-apoptotic state. And so now we have our patient here, and this is how we're having this modern treatment discussion. We say, do you want fixed duration or indefinite therapy? That's really what we're asking. We have fixed duration treatment with obinutuzumab plus venetoclax, or we have indefinite therapy with a BTK inhibitor. We have three BTK inhibitors now. We have the first one, which was ibrutinib, and then we have newer ones, acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib. But bottom line is those you have to take forever, whereas obinutuzumab venetoclax is a fixed duration. In the future, are we going to see differences in all of these? Are we going to actually see fixed duration other regimens? Yes, but right now we have obinutuzumab venetoclax as one option, or indefinite BTK inhibitor therapy with something like ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, or zanubrutinib. And the data behind this, we're going to summarize in our show notes. You know, I don't want to bore all of our listeners with all of the data and how all of this happened, but really very, very briefly to discuss the two pivotal trials that I want to just for today with this. One trial is called CLL14, and that looked at obinutuzumab venetoclax versus obinutuzumab chlorambucil. Why did we choose that comparator arm? Why not another BTK inhibitor like ibrutinib or acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib, which we knew worked? I don't know. That's a good question. The interesting thing about that study is they only included elderly patients with comorbidities. So they really said, hey, we're trying to look at the elderly patients with comorbidities. Can we get them to tolerate venetoclax plus obinutuzumab? And the answer was yes. I mean, there was a PFS benefit. There was an overall survival benefit. In subgroups of 17P, we found that they did very well. And we think in subgroup analysis, some of those patients with mutated IGHV may have a durable remission that may result in cure. So obinutuzumab venetoclax fixed duration, it's 1 year of therapy, is something that works well for patients. We knew that from that CLL14 trial. Then we had the indefinite therapies of BTK inhibitors, the one I want to talk about today, because remember, you can use ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib. What's the difference? The newer generations are more selective and have less AFib, about half the rate of AFib. So you're having much less AFib with the newer generations. And the trial that's important is called ELEVATE-TN. And the key thing in that trial that was presented at ASH 2023 is we found that obinutuzumab plus acalabrutinib, remember, this isn't fixed duration, you're still taking the acalabrutinib forever, but obinutuzumab plus acalabrutinib had an overall survival benefit over obinutuzumab chlorambucil. So it showed an overall survival benefit, but acalabrutinib alone without the obinutuzumab did not have an overall survival benefit over chlorambucil obinutuzumab. So what are we saying here? Adding the obinutuzumab to the BTK inhibitor ended up resulting in an overall survival benefit with acalabrutinib, that newer generation BTK. We did not see the same for ibrutinib. There was a prior trial that looked at ibrutinib rituximab versus ibrutinib alone versus chemo rituximab, essentially, and there was no benefit of adding rituximab to the BTK inhibitor, but there was an overall survival benefit of adding the BTK inhibitor to obinutuzumab. So today, if we're talking about these patients, I used to say you have an infusion-free option, but now today I have to say, well, there is an overall survival benefit with obinutuzumab. So you still have 6 infusions, roughly, of obinutuzumab. So 6 months of infusions kind of with obinutuzumab plus that BTK inhibitor versus this, which is indefinite, versus this fixed-duration therapy with obinutuzumab and venetoclax.
Just to kind of follow up on that, with there being so many different options, I mean, you know, certainly presenting patients with the option of saying indefinite versus continuous therapy is definitely one way to sort of decide one way or another. But let's say a patient is interested in going with the small molecule option and wants to undergo treatment with a BTK inhibitor. How do you then decide who's going to be eligible for, I don't know, as you're saying, acalabrutinib combined with obinutuzumab versus just treating them with like an ibrutinib or something like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. We've studied this in the relapsed refractory setting. There's been non-inferiority studies looking at ibrutinib versus acalabrutinib was one of them, and that was called ELEVATE-RR, and another one that looked at ibrutinib versus zanubrutinib called ALPINE. So those were the two studies where we looked at the question of newer generation versus ibrutinib alone. And for the ELEVATE-RR, there was really no difference. It was non-inferior. Acalabrutinib was non-inferior to ibrutinib for PFS, but it had a much better toxicity profile. That we're talking about half the rates of hypertension, half the rates of AFib, much, much better tolerated. And so acalabrutinib is a very, very reasonable option. This is the only drug that we have overall survival benefit with obinutuzumab right now. We don't have the same data with zanubrutinib. So that kind of might say, oh, well, you know, this is a good toxicity profile. When talking about zanubrutinib versus ibrutinib in that ALPINE study, technically it met superiority, but the primary endpoint was overall response rate, which makes absolutely no sense to me at all in CLL to have a primary endpoint of a continuous therapy as overall response rate. It makes zero sense. So sure, does it have more response? Yes. But are we saying that it's really superior to ibrutinib? We cannot say that for PFS and OS. That has not been determined yet. And in that trial, the zanubrutinib, the one downside of it is that it had caused probably a little bit more neutropenia and had a higher incidence of pneumonias and COVID-19 pneumonias. So when I think about it, is zanubrutinib superior to ibrutinib? I don't think we can say that. Is it less toxic? Definitely from a cardiac standpoint, maybe a little bit more neutropenia infections, not a huge signal, but maybe a little bit more. And then we know that acalabrutinib with obinutuzumab has an overall survival benefit. So it's very reasonable to say, I'm going to choose acalabrutinib or obinutuzumab. If somebody said, hey, I like zanubrutinib for whatever reason, that's not wrong either. I mean, I would say zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib are both very well-tolerated drugs. They still have a risk of AFib. Don't forget about it. They still have a risk of hypertension, so you got to watch that closely, and they still have the bleeding risk. But for those two, some will argue, oh, well, zanubrutinib was superior, but that's an overall response rate. I don't buy it.
That's good to know. I think this is fantastic, and I think the discussions are great, and Vivek, I appreciate you shedding the real world sort of experience with a lot of these drugs, because I think that's the reality, right? It makes treatment decisions a lot harder when there's a menu of options to pick from, but it's helpful to sort of hear, aside from the data, what is a tolerability of the drug? What is the convenience factor of the drug? How often are people needing to come to infusion centers? I know where we are at Rouleau right now that access to care can be difficult, and so a lot of our patients drive really far. These are things that we also want to be considering in these conversations.
And along with that, with venetoclax, obinutuzumab, that fixed duration, you have a ton of lab monitoring because of the risk of tumor lysis syndrome. So I also tell the patient, look, you're going to have like a lot of lab monitoring initially, a lot more visits up front. If the patient's older, sometimes they're like, I don't want to do that. Just give me the pill and let me go and let me live my life. And that's totally, totally reasonable for a patient to do that. And so I think that's another important thing. The last thing I want to say, which I didn't really mention, is why do we not use FCR anymore? Because it's incredibly toxic and ibrutinib beat FCR. So that is why we don't use FCR anymore. You're looking at these two options of fixed duration versus continuous therapy.
That sounds great. Guys, if we can, let's just quickly summarize what our treatment options are in 2024 for a patient with CLL, assuming that we need to treat the patient.
Assuming we need to treat the patient right now, we have BTK inhibitor, choose your own adventure, continuous, or we have fixed duration, obinutuzumab plus venetoclax. Difference is one's continuous, one's fixed duration. The fixed duration option requires more frequent lab monitoring for tumor lysis syndrome.
That sounds great. All right, guys. Well, I think that was a great episode. I think it really hit a lot of key points. I think we really well integrated the information that we've been talking about for weeks with the hemolytic anemia, how we put that into context of a very complicated patient, and ultimately deciding how we use all this information to make treatment decisions for our patients. So I think this is a good place to stop here. Any final thoughts that you all have?
I think that was a great case. I'm really glad you were able to share that with us. Like Ronick said, it kind of covered a lot of different areas of CLL care.
It was fun going through this. And listeners, check out our show notes. Everything will be outlined chronologically for all of the relevant trials in CLL, even the ones we didn't talk about today.
That sounds good. All right, guys. Well, then until next time, we'll see you all later.
See you later.
Peace.